This week in Retronauts, evil forces take heed. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish. No, not Jeremy Parrish, dear Quark. Magic Emperor Jeremy Parrish. And this week we are talking about Lunar, or if you prefer, Lunar. But let's not, let's Lunar. This, of course, is a... how would you describe its place in history now? Like, once upon a time, in a brief window, it was kind of a big deal, and now it's kind of mostly forgotten.
Right. I mean, I would say that in the 1990s, in the Western, you know, North American RPG fan base, it was probably second only to Final Fantasy in terms of, you know, popularity. It was cult favorite.
I agree. But whose mysterious voice is that?
Oh, yes. My name is Todd Selick. I worked with Bob and Jeremy back in 1UP.com. And right now I do a few other things. I do a blog and I'll get to that later. At the end. It's okay.
Well, no, I think your bona fides can be presented up front. You are very knowledgeable about this particular corner of video game history, about, you know, Sega CD type development and publishers, you know, companies like Renovation and Wolf Team, and of course, Game Arts and Team Alex or Studio Alex. So right. when I decided it would be cool to talk about Lunar, you were the first person who came to mind. So I'm glad you were able to join the show. Of course, also the old standby, old faithful, as ever, out in Berkeley.
Hey, everybody, I'm Bob Mackey, and I poop diamonds. That's a reference. And by the way, I will be saying Lunar, because that's how all of the press material, that's all of the spoken English language called it in the past, like, 20 years, so now that's in my head. So
no, it's totally understandable.
I don't know why.
I try not to be a stickler for pronunciation on anything that I do. I try to, you know, be accurate for myself. But in this case, yeah, it's one of those things where it's just supposed to be Lunar. But for whatever reason, Working Designs, when they localized it, said, no, it's Lunar, and emphasized that second syllable. And so that's, you know, that's how a lot of people came to came to see it.
Maybe they were trying to cover up the whole moon thing, like trying to bury that a bit. So it wasn't immediately obvious, because I didn't even think of the word like lunar meaning moon or moon related when I bought this game like in the 90s.
Oh, yes. It took me way too long to realize that that was the deal. I was like, oh, you know, that blue star is really big. I mean, I wonder, is it the sun or something? Or
is that North America? What's going on up there? yeah, actually, so this might be a good opportunity for each of us to talk briefly about how we first came to discover the Lunar series, because I feel like there are actually quite a few points of entry for the series. I think most people probably came along with the PlayStation era, but there have been points in history before that and after that where someone could conceivably have played Lunar for the first time and said, God damn, this is good. So, Todd, how about yourself?
Well, when I was a kid, basically, I was a Super Nintendo kid for a lot of the 1990s, but I would always be envious of the Sega Genesis, and Lunar was really the RPG that everyone with a Sega CD bragged about. Because, you know, it had voices, it had animation, it had really everything that a Final Fantasy game would have. And so when I finally got it around to buying a Sega CD, it was discounted, I made sure I got Lunar 2, because that was said to be even better. And I think I actually paid more for Lunar 2 than I paid for the Sega CD itself. It was totally worth it, though. The game floored me. I was amazed by it. So I think when I went back and played Lunar 1, I was a little more, I was like, oh, this is good, but, you know, it's not 2. So, and then when the PlayStation remakes came along, I was right there to pick them up. So, yeah, it was not exactly in order, but that's how I came to Lunar.
All right. And Bob, how about you?
I only came to this series in the PlayStation remake generation. And of course, I drooled over these games in game magazines back in the day before, like 5 years before they were released on the PlayStation. But I had a Super Nintendo. I was not about to buy a Sega Genesis and a Sega CD. I did not actually get a Sega CD for the first time until the year 2000. And then by that time, those games were very, very expensive.
Really? I'll back that soon.
Yeah, it's I mean they're expensive, meaning they were like $80, not like $300 or whatever, but still.
Now with the whatever working design themes sell for now.
But yeah, I did love these games, and I do feel like a huge part of the appeal, and I'm sure we'll definitely talk about this later, is that especially in this era, being an RPG gamer really felt like you were a persecuted class in a persecuted class, and this made you feel like you're in a special little club with people who understood you, and the entire working designs bubble really helped to make this game seem more appealing than it was in reality, I think.
Did either of you post on the working designs forums?
Oh, definitely. Website? Yes.
Yeah. Bob, what was your handle there?
I'm pretty sure it was Bob Servo. Like it has been everywhere for the past 20 years.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
I might've posted not in the 90s, but I think like maybe in the mid 2000s, early 2000s when there were kind of going dormant, I guess I may have posted there. I had this strange phobia of posting on forums until like 2000. It was very odd.
You were extremely online after that.
Yes.
Yeah. So for myself, Lunar and basically any Sega based RPG was kind of outside my perspective for a long time, like out of my view, aside from Phantasy Star. Of course, everyone knew what Phantasy Star was, but because I could only afford, you know, one platform and ended up going with Nintendo, Super Nintendo, I just didn't know anything about these games. But it just so happened that in the late 90s, I got my first job, my first real job. So I had my first real disposable income. And that was right around the time that 8 and 16-bit systems and games were just being kind of cleared out. And my town had actually quite a few really good, if that's the word for it, pawn shops where video games would show up, sometimes complete in box. Like I would occasionally stumble across like Chrono Trigger for $15 and be like, hey, this is a person I know on a message board. I know you were looking for this game. I'll give it to you for cost. And so I ended up getting a Sega CD for like, I don't know, $50 or so. Very inexpensive for a working expansion, considering it originally sold for like $300. And I ended up finding both the Lunar games at different times, complete in box, you know, complete with their glossy manuals and embossments and everything, probably for like $30 or $40 a piece. Mm. So I came to them kind of late. You know, the PlayStation was already out, but the PlayStation remakes of these games were not yet out. So I guess it was probably like 96, 97, and played both and said, oh, these are really good, especially Lunar 2. Like I was pleasantly surprised by how good Lunar 2 was, especially once I thought I'd beaten the game and realized, oh no, actually this is just picking up. This is just kind of getting going. So yeah, they made a really great impression on me. And I was like, you know, this working designs company, they seem pretty plucky. I think I like them. So I kind of became a regular on their forums and was, you know, just kind of generally getting into RPGs. And of course followed the Lunar games. And actually those were some of the first games I wrote about, not in a professional capacity, but I wrote about them for my personal website and did some stuff for the Gaming Intelligence Agency. So I have a soft spot for these games. And I realize there's probably not much of a future for the Lunar series, but you know, it's always kind of nice to hope and think maybe they can finally come up with a proper sequel to Lunar and not let Dragon Song be the last statement for the franchise.
Oh, definitely. That's a heck of a note to go out on there.
Yeah, I think if Grandia can get re-releases, surely Lunar could at least get a re-release.
I wonder. I think the rights around Lunar are very complicated, and not even because of working designs, but because of the relationship with Studio Alex. I know, Todd, you added some stuff to the notes. Do you want to talk about that now, or do we want to talk about that later? Should we even talk about what Studio Alex is? That might be a good place to start.
Well, Studio Alex was a consultation company that was affiliated with Game Arts. It was kind of like, I would say, Red Company, where they don't actually do the programming so much as they do the concepts and stories and sometimes direction. Mm-hmm. They were started by a gentleman named Kazunari Tomy. And he was kind of by the time Lunar was in development, he was kind of a veteran of RPGs. He worked on older RPGs at a company called, I think it was Crystalsoft. Mm-hmm. And he was also at Falcom. So he worked on the East games and things like that. And so that was a major part of the RPG element of Lunar. And of course, they were also with Game Arts, and Game Arts had done, you know, Thexter and Alicia Dragoon and some other
Silphied
things. Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, so more of an action game type studio than an RPG studio. Although I think after the Lunar game's success, you started to think of Game Arts as being a little more pitched toward RPGs.
Oh, yes, yes.
I was just going to say, the original Lunar was one of the first RPGs, if not the first RPG, designed for the Sega CD and to really take advantage of Sega CD, as opposed to being like, you know, a Genesis game that had Redbook audio or like some sort of, you know, FMV type intro grafted onto it. Like, this was designed from the ground up to be a CD-based role-playing game. And it wasn't the first CD-based RPG, you know, to have been designed, but as you, you mentioned in the notes, the ones that kind of preceded it were for the PC Engine CD-ROM 2, and that platform did not have a lot of penetration in the US, especially compared to the Sega CD.
Right. And even the early Sega CD RPGs like Fey Area and Isle Lord, there were early like Telenet games. They didn't come out in North America and they didn't really have that much of an impact. They felt very much like Genesis games that just had mm-hmm. better music and sometimes mm-hmm. introductions and stuff like that. So for Lunar, it was really sort of the big Sega CD RPG. And I mean, I think by 1993, the Sega CD had almost maybe 500,000 units moved, I think. So you had a lot of people who were looking for more than just, you know, Sonic CD and some full motion video games, especially in America.
And speaking of Sonic CD, that is the only game, I believe, for Sega CD that outsold Lunar in the US. And I believe Lunar is actually the best selling. I put it in the notes. It's either the best selling or second best selling Sega or slash Mega Drive CD game ever released. Like, it was a really, really big hit in Japan, considering the size of the platform, and just really caught hold. And, you know, going back to that idea of an RPG designed for the Sega CD platform, what I mean by that is that, you know, again, it wasn't just a Sega Genesis ROM with some extra stuff tacked onto it. And you really kind of see it sort of show its hand early on with the famous Boat Song, where there is an interlude, you know, a few hours into the game, where the lead female character, Luna, actually has a like a showstopper. She sings a song. And it seems kind of hokey now, but at the time, like, you just didn't get that. You didn't get, you know, this big sort of musical production. I mean, this was a few years before Final Fantasy VI with the opera scene, which honestly was probably inspired to a certain degree by the sequence in Lunar, where it's just like you couldn't have done this on a cartridge. Not only was she singing with, you know, CD quality audio, but there was a cutscene that accompanied it. And it was, you know, integrated into the story and a key element of the plot, you know, from which kind of the rest of the game unfolds. So it was really designed with the sensibility of, hey, this is next generation hardware. This is a platform. It is about more than just like, you know, having some extra niceties tacked on. Like, this can be an essential part of telling the story within the game. This can be, you know, this technology can enable us to express our ideas and make you, you know, feel closer to the characters and make you kind of a part of their journey. And I think, you know, in that sense, it was really successful. And, you know, again, you have to turn back the hands of time almost 30 years where we were just used to seeing RPGs, especially being kind of like sort of the lowest tier of visual fidelity when it came to video games, because so much of the available ROM data was dedicated toward story and dialogue and music and monster sprites and things like that and combat logic. There was just so much that you had to deal with an RPG that usually visuals kind of took a back seat. And this was still, you know, kind of a game designed in that sort of squat, super deformed style where you had little squashy headed sprites. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, it had all these cutscenes woven throughout, and there were so many different environments and backgrounds, and it just felt like a bigger game. And really, you know, compared to something like Dragon Quest V or Final Fantasy V or Phantasy Star III, you know, it just seemed, it seemed grander and at the same time a little more intimate, because it was really about telling these character stories.
Yeah, it wouldn't be until a few years later that Squaresoft and Enix would actually make very good looking games. I think like 94 and 95 were when they started really turning things around graphically, but this game is 92.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we talk about how great some of those latter day 16-bit RPGs are on cartridges, I think you really have to look to games like Lunar that were on CD-ROM and really kind of push the boundaries of what people expected in terms of visual fidelity from RPGs. And I think that lit a fire under the people who were making games for cartridges. And of course, Square wanted to be on the CD-ROM bandwagon, and that fell out from under them when Nintendo was like, ha, just kidding, Sony. So they were kind of denied that opportunity, and you know, that led to them, you know, buying these enormous ROM chips along with Enix and you know, for like Tales of Phantasia and Star Ocean, Namco also. So, you know, that led to their games becoming more expensive, and you know, that kind of hastened the demise of RPGs on cartridges, I think, for a long time. But yeah, I just think we tend to overlook kind of the impact that these CD-ROM based games had, and how much they must have been like, you know, just instilling a sort of envy in people who were still developing for cartridges.
Yeah, I can only imagine what Square must have thought when they had to cancel, you know, their CD-ROM Secret of Mana, and then they saw Lunar doing really well.
I was just thinking of that. That's probably why that game looks so much better than any other Square game of that era, just because it started as a CD-ROM project.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I think they assumed, oh, we're going to have lots of space to work with this, but then they ended up not. And so it's a really janky and buggy game, but it does look nice. And that was kind of like the inflection point from which their RPGs started to look nicer. But again, like, if you look at Lunar in the context of its era, it really was kind of a, you know, do a double take. And I don't think it was the first RPG that Working Designs had localized for the US, but, you know, stuff like Cosmic Fantasy II were more of that sort of traditional, like, hey, we stuck some FMV at the beginning of a, you know, basically a Who card game. This was not that. And it sold really, really well. They treated it very, you know, like as it was a deluxe product with a really thick manual with a glossy, like UV coated cover and embossments. And I think they had like five different CD-ROM labels that were kind of randomly distributed. So they kind of created this collector's mentality, a chase item. And at the same time, it was just like, you know, here is a really nice package, much better than, you know, so many Sega CD manuals were like, you know, the color cover and then black and white interior. And this was not that. This was a deluxe package. Mm-hmm.
And I even remember that for the first printing of Lunar, the back was not, it didn't have that foil embossment. So for the second printings, you could send in the back insert to Working Designs, and they would replace it for you and give you a free Lunar pin to go along with it. Huh. So they were really dedicated to the packaging there.
Well, that and also, you know, that creates a great relationship with your customers to basically say, like, hey, you got here earlier than everyone else, and we really appreciate that. So we're going to make sure that you get what everyone who came after you got, but also a little bonus to say thanks. That's always a good tactic for, you know, building a strong fan base. And they really did. Like, people really loved Working Designs games. And, you know, Working Designs was a pretty controversial company. It's a founder, Vic Ireland, was very controversial as well. We'll talk about that later. But, you know, for every person who panned Working Designs for their choices, they had someone who was an equally dedicated fan who just loved their work and really appreciated the extra effort they put into their games. Even if, you know, even if they didn't necessarily agree with the direction those changes took, like the fact that they were doing all this really spoke to the fact that, hey, they give a shit about this game, and they really, you know, they really are putting their heart into it. And that's so much better than what, you know, you were seeing with games like Lagoon or Paladin's Quest or something, where it's just like, they didn't even bother to localize like proper English into this. They don't care.
Yeah, and we can look at the localization of Lunar and the other games now, and it does seem a little, you know, it can seem juvenile and maybe going too far and rewriting things, but it was really refreshing back then because you rarely saw that sort of flavoring in video games. I mean, you might see something like Dragon View or Troubleshooter where someone went over the text and tried to make it, you know, Americanized, but what Working Designs was doing back then was really unique.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the Nintendo side of things, you know, there were a few games that were competently localized, well localized. You had the ridiculous faux Middle Ages English for like faux Shakespearean English for Dragon Warrior and its sequels, and you know, that at least gave it some personality. But this, I think, the Lunar games were the first time that localizers actually kind of inserted themselves into the process and were like, hey, we're the folks who brought this game to English. Let's talk a little bit about our dedication to it. And that was nice. It made you realize like, oh, there's people who are actually taking these products and turning them into something that works better for me. And they actually care about grammar, which is rare. How nice. So,
Oh yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's quite all right. I mean, I was going to bring up, you know, Ted Wolsey's translations for the Square games, which are kind of back then they were generally regarded as pretty very, very good. But they didn't really, you know, intrude too much on the actual meaning of things. And they didn't really try to flavor every townsperson's conversation. So you would still have to go through the usual RPG routines where you would walk around the town, talk to people, and they might, some of them say the same thing. And with Working Designs, I felt that that was really where they kind of tried to change and spice things up, because you would actually be, when I played, I would be looking forward to talking to every person in the town just to see what they would say. You never knew if it was going to be something plot related or if they just make a joke about Tootsie Pops or something.
Right. It's like, wow, someone in this game made a joke about Star Wars. That's cool. they dropped a Star Wars reference. You never see that in pop culture and video games.
Yeah,
it was a different time.
There was so much dialogue compared to other games of the time. Like, you would talk to the townspeople, they'd go through like their two or three pages of regular dialogue, and then you talk to them right after that, there'd be like another page of dialogue, and then after like every event, you could conceivably go back to most towns to hear new things. It was actually slightly overwhelming at times. I think it's why I crapped out on the epilogue of the second game.
Yeah, that's fair, but it definitely made you feel like, wow, there's a lot happening here, and it no longer feels like just kind of this tedious chore to talk to people. Like, I can be assured that I'm going to see something interesting if I talk to people. It might be a Bill Clinton joke, but still,
a joke about welfare. all the hits are there.
Oh, the Baywatch joke right outside the last dungeon was, I remember that from Linder 2.
I don't remember that one, but
Final Fantasy VI was classy. We just got one Beavis and Butthead reference, and that's all we got.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Of course, the localization changes that Working Designs made on these games were not just to the script, although they did heavily rewrite the script, put in a ton of jokes, pop culture references. They also habitually rebalanced the difficulty. Sometimes they felt like, well, some of these battles are way too tedious, so let's, you know, change up the amount of damage that you do to bosses, the amount of damage bosses do to you, so they go faster and they're, you know, more challenging and less drawn out. Sometimes they would say, this game is actually too easy, so we're going to reduce your damage output and increase the damage output of enemies, and also you'll get less experience, which, you know, kind of made the game more tedious. They would even make some story related changes. I think the first Lunar is kind of infamous for the fact that at the very end, when you're approaching the goddess Althina, she's like trying to blast you with lightning, and it's just kind of like an automated sequence. But in the American version, they changed it so you can be zapped by the lightning, and it's really almost impossible to reach her without getting destroyed because it hits you really hard. So you have to make use of Alex's, and the first game is harp, and the remake is ocarina, and actually play it to kind of evoke the memory of, you know, the boat song and everything, and bring Althina back to her senses, which is a neat little touch, but it's not something that the designers of the game actually put in there themselves. So, you know, it does kind of raise the question of authorial intent. Like, is it right for the localizers to actually change the climax of the game? Like, I think it's a neat touch, and, you know, it does kind of draw back to the characters, But at the same time, like, did they clear that with the developers? I think in this case they did, because Game Arts actually did the localization programming, but later Working Design started taking things in-house to do the reprogramming themselves, the localization programming. And I don't know that they necessarily cleared all their changes mm-hmm. with developers, which I think created some friction and might have, you know, kind of hastened that company's demise, because I think that, you know, sometimes they made some modifications that the creators were like, wait a minute.
Yeah, I know they made some other games like actually much worse, like Silhouette Mirage, and I think mm-hmm. like one of the Cosmic Fantasy 2, which is, I haven't played, but I've heard what their changes did to the game, and it's not
well
good.
There was Exile 2, which I think can't yes. actually be beaten. Yeah.
Oh, that's the one I'm thinking of. Yes,
it's almost impossible to beat because they made it so hard. And to hear them talk about that for their Victor Island tell it, basically back in the day before they were reprogramming them in-house, they had to basically send the code and the files back to the developers in Japan, and they only had like so many times they could do that before they got charged an exponentially larger amount of money. So it was much trickier back then making those kinds of changes. So I think you'll see a lot of changes back then that maybe weren't quite entirely thought through.
Yeah, you definitely... You can still find people who are very sore about changes Working Designs made to games. And, you know, I agree that some of them made games for the worse. Although I think like with Alundra, they actually made the boss battles way less tedious, didn't they? Didn't the bosses used to take like a billion hits to take down? And they were like, we'll just make the bosses stronger and you'll be stronger. And so it'll be a shorter fight, but you have to, you know, really be good at dodging the bosses so you don't get just destroyed by a few hits.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So it wasn't always bad. Like they weren't spurious changes. And I feel like they put a lot of thought into it, even if we don't necessarily agree with the decisions they came to.
All right. And I did enjoy some games when they were a little more difficult. I mean, Popful Mail is a controversial one because it's a lot easier to die in that game, but I almost prefer it that way because it makes it a little more of a rewarding experience when you go through it. And for their shooters, they would actually make it so you couldn't really credit feed through the game. You'd have to you could only like get to level 3 with infinite continues or something. Mm-hmm. So I appreciated that as well. So yeah, not to bag too heavy on Working Designs because I do like a lot of the things that they did.
Yeah, and, you know, they brought this game to the U.S., which, honestly, I don't know that Lunar would have come to the U.S. without them stepping in and saying, hey, we're going to take on this massive game. It had a huge script, and I think they localized it in something like 8 weeks. Just a crazy amount of work in a very short amount of time. And it came out really well. They had actually some pretty talented voice actors come in and do the English overdubs for... I think there's only like 5 or 6 voiced characters in the original Sega CD game, but still, like, it's good quality voice acting. It's not like, you know, we found a janitor, stuck him in a closet with a micro cassette recorder and said, go for it. We'll just take your first read. They really actually put some thought into it. And they even rewrote the introductory song, which was made to be more upbeat and energetic in a very early 90s kind of... aerobics VHS workout tape kind of way. I'm a big fan, but it's extremely dated.
Yeah, it's got some Olivia Newton-John inspirations there.
All through the night,
yes.
See, I'm more familiar with the, you know, All Dreams Are Real Unless You Dream They're Not version of that song.
Oh, from the Silver Star Story.
Yeah,
complete, yes.
Yeah. So, like, I only heard the Sega CD one on the soundtrack that came with Silver Star Story Complete.
Yeah. That's something that I think people who didn't get to play the games on Sega CD missed out on, because that introduction, you know, the Sega CD version didn't have true anime, like cell animation. It was the very elaborate bitmap art, the kind of, you know, the kind of thing you would see on like a PC 9801 game in Japan, but with more animation. There were more of those cutscenes. But the introduction is definitely very elaborate with a lot of really nice big sprite art that's kind of reacting in time to the Olivia Newton-John workout song.
Yeah, and
it's really great. I really love it. It's so of its time. It's so good.
They were emulating like an anime TV opening, which not even like Ease was doing in the on those earlier games.
Yeah, and just a side note on that, I do think a lot of Lunar's popularity had an effect because it coincided with the rise of anime fandom in North America. That was becoming more and more popular in the early 90s, and so you could go to Suncoast and get your Ranma or Tenchi Muyo tapes, and then you could get that same thing on your Sega CD.
Yeah. I totally agree with Todd. Like, both the scarcity of anime and also the working designs bubble really made these games special, because anime, despite there being like a shelf at Suncoast, it was such a drip feed from Japan. There were still like relatively few titles coming over, especially like in 93. So just having something with like an anime character on it felt special, especially with a very anime infused product like this.
Yeah,
because
I mean,
back then.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say that even for RPGs back then, you rarely even saw anime characters on the covers. Square didn't really play that up or anything like that. Sorry, Jeremy.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, kind of to your point about the whole Suncoast anime revolution, the kind of the main impetus for me wanting to tackle this topic is because I've dug up my Ranma 1/2 Blu-rays and I've been watching those as I exercise, and me back to this period of history where I was, buying Ranma 1/2 two episodes at a time for $30 per cassette tape, and buying cheap Sega CD games at the pawn shop, and just really Japan dorking it out as much as possible in West Texas. And this is very much of that sort of same period of time where it's like, wow, they made some really cool stuff in Japan. It's neat that this stuff, we can play this. I want to know more about this mysterious country where they eat raw fish. How
and
cool.
It was much harder to import things like soundtracks and, gaming merch. So I really feel like, and I put this in the notes, that like the complete versions were just like your weeb starter kit back when that just started to become an approachable thing, importing things, because it came with like, oh, it comes with a soundtrack and a map and like all these things that we would never get in games, but Japan was getting a lot of at the time.
Yeah, I mean, the packages they put together for the complete versions of these for PlayStation are really kind of the baseline package for limited editions that you see in games now. And that's something you really didn't get in the console space at that point. And now, I work at Limited Run Games, and that's kind of like working design style is basically our starting point. And then we're like, well, maybe we should do something different and new with this time, with this game. What can we do that we haven't done before? But that is kind of the starting point. Like, we looked to see what working designs did, and we were like, the CD and some pins or a map or, prints or something. Punching puppet, maybe.
You guys mastered non-stinky map technology.
Yes, it took a long time.
I was going to ask if you're planning to do a Shantae punching puppet or something like that, or
not that I'm aware of, but I feel like the idea of a punching puppet has been kicked around at some point, because it's iconic and weird. All right, so we've kind of talked around the games quite a bit so far, but let's talk about the Lunar games, or at least the first Lunar game. I don't know if we're going to have time to talk about all of them, but the original Lunar was released in 1992 for Mega CD in Japan. It was localized the following year in the U.S. For Sega CD by Working Designs, originally developed by Game Arts and Studio Alex. Okay, great. So these were role-playing games in very much the sort of traditional Japanese-style role-playing game mold. Like, they didn't really break the boundaries in any way. They were very sort of comfortable, like, in the sense of Breath of Fire, where it's like, oh, yeah, these are RPGs. Like, I know exactly what I'm going to get from these. And there's a few little grace notes, but nothing that's just going to, like, totally shake up the medium. But it was fine for that.
And they're very much in the tradition that kind of started with East, where you have the hero meeting a blue-haired girl who's mysteriously connected to a mysterious power. And you saw the same thing in the Lufia games. So they very much deal with that sort of cliche, but they do a very good job of broadening it, I think, especially in Lunar 2. But, I mean, in the original Lunar, it's – I want to say there are a lot of little touches that I think enhance things. For example, you have the hero Alex. He has his friend Ramus. Oh, I'm sorry. And it doesn't really do that much in battle. He kind of just doesn't he run away in a lot of the dungeons?
He's like the Milhouse of that game.
Yes.
Well, I feel like he's kind of a younger version of Torneko from Dragon Quest IV. But instead of being like the shopkeeper who becomes a hero, he's the guy who's like, you know, actually, I don't want to be a hero. I'm going to go be a shopkeeper.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a nice change from the RPGs where, you know, all the hero's childhood friends just so happen to be sword fighters and mages and archers and things. So that was something really interesting. And then you had, you know, his Alex, like you mentioned in the notes, Jeremy, Alex really didn't have too much personality, but he had his little flying cat dragon, Nahl, to sort of talk him along.
Right. Nahl was kind of his Jiminy Cricket, who, you know, transforms into a dragon later. But yeah, I think, you know, a lot of the sort of the vibe of this game draws from Studio Ghibli and Nadia of the Blue Water. Mm. And, you know, of course, Castle in the Sky, where you have kind of this humble kind of young man of common origins who rises to become a hero and turns out to be extraordinary. And he's kind of motivated, you know, spurred into action by his friendship and affection for a girl that he, in this case, it's a nice touch because they're childhood friends. They know each other. And, you know, there is already this kind of intimacy and closeness between them, but they're still young. And it's not like they have a serious or even necessarily romantic relationship. It's kind of budding in that direction. So instead of, you know, being introduced to some mysterious girl from far away, it's more that the girl he knows, his childhood friend, the girl next door, turns out to have mysterious powers and be connected to a much greater destiny through events that happened before either of them were born. But it still does draw very heavily on that sort of Gainax Ghibli sort of heritage. Like, it's extremely anime in that respect.
Right. And they're at the you can trace that back to, of course, through Game Arts, because they were affiliated with Gainax a lot during the late 1980s and things. On Alicia Dragoon, that was, I think, the game Game Arts made right before Lunar. It was actually made in conjunction with Gainax. Sorry. And it even has references to a Silver Star, and the way they do the opening credits over a little ancient, you know, wall carving. That's kind of very similar to the style they used in Lunar.
I mean, that's also very similar to the style in Nausicaa and the style in Castle in the Sky. So it's definitely a very Hayao Miyazaki sort of trope.
Right. And it wouldn't surprise me if some of the people who worked on, you know, Lunar actually went back to Nausicaa, because they did have a lot of the anime industry experience at Game Arts. And the character designer, Toshiyuki Kabuka, I believe his name is, he was actually doing the designs for Giant Robo, which was kind of a prestigious anime direct-to-video feature.
I think he also did Irresponsible Captain Tyler as well.
I think, something with that, yeah. So they gathered some talent together for the Lunar games. Again, not to go too much back into the anime thing, sorry.
No, but I mean, I think it's connections to familiar anime, like very, very successful anime, drawing on some of those elements and tropes and themes. I think, you know, that's not a lack of creativity or vision there. I think it's a very deliberate choice to say, like, we are trying to evoke, you know, the same spirit you got from these movies. And just by using these kind of introductory elements, we're setting the stage and setting your expectations, because you, as an experienced fan of these films, you kind of know what they're about and the atmosphere that they create and the importance of friendship and camaraderie and just basic human decency. And that's what we're trying to tell a story about here. So, you know, kind of setting the stage with those very familiar elements before telling their own story that goes in its own direction. And, you know, I don't think you would look at the first Lunar and say, well, oh, yeah, this whole thing is just stupid and derivative, because it goes in some pretty interesting directions narratively. But kind of using that familiar, like, Miyazaki-esque introductory pastiche, I think, you know, it does really calibrate what you can expect from this game and put you in the right kind of the right mood to, you know, to make you receptive and to really enjoy the game.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
I don't want to linger on this too long, but it kind of proves how innocent I was in that this is a very, very like, I don't know, not a pervy game, I don't think. But something I got hung up on as like a teenager playing this is that Alex is in love with Luna, but she's not just the girl next door. She's also his adopted sister. And I was just like, I guess they're not related, but she's kind of his sister. I don't know how to feel about this. And I was not ready for the future of erotica, clearly. But they don't do anything pervy with it, but I was always kind of hung up on that fact.
Is it wrong to hit on your adopted sister in a dungeon?
If she's hot, it's totally cool. If you're in an anime. Okay.
So those are the kind of the main cast, the sort of starter pack cast. But, you know, a few hours into the game in Lunar the Silver Star, the Sega CD game, Alex and Null kind of go off on their own. You know, Rammus decides, I want to open a shop, you know, now that I've gotten to the big city. And so see you later, arrivederci. And Luna, you know, being just a domestic type gal, decides to stay back home in the town of Berg and is basically a non-entity in the story for a long time until she becomes very important in the story. And so then, you know, Alex begins adventuring and he meets kind of the previous generation of heroes. And, you know, there's lots of foreshadowing and references and things like that to kind of make you think, well, you know, there's something bigger going on here. But he puts together basically a new party with people he meets kind of in the bigger world, people especially from the Flying Magic Academy, again, you know, Castle in the Sky-esque an academy. So like three of the party members he eventually teams up with out of, you know, a total of four companions plus Null are mages, which is kind of heavily loaded toward mages. For most RPGs.
Yeah, I think so. Like the other attacking character is like the barbarian type, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got Kyle the meathead. And then Jessica is a half beast cleric.
Right.
So she's a priest, but she's also, you know, very, what is it, sundere? Is that the right word? She's like hot tempered. She's kind of got a thing for Kyle and he's got a thing for her, but they're also both very stubborn and hot headed. Then there's Nash, who is basically a preening cocky jackass, but he's also a very good wizard. And then Mia, who is very, very shy and is also a wizard. You can tell she's shy because she wears pink. And so those kind of become your party members. I'm trying to remember, in the Silver Star, can you take all five into combat at once, or is there a limit on who you can take with you?
I don't remember there being a party system. I think everyone's just in it to win it.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I played the Sega CD game, so I don't remember exactly how their different magic specialties break out, aside from Jessica, you know, obviously being a cleric, would have more healing spells. I think Mia was kind of like a... If I'm not mistaken, I think she was more like an all-rounder, like a red mage type, and then Nash was much more of the wizard, you know, Final Fantasy black mage, casting offensive magic and that sort of thing. Yeah, I think Mia was like support and, you know, kind of dual casting. And then Kyle was just like, hit things with sword real hard.
Yeah, definitely. And even though then the original Sega CD, they sort of had very somewhat basic personalities, Working Designs did really try to give them, you know, expand them things, especially because in a lot of RPGs, once you recruit a character, they won't really have that much to do with the plot overall. But in the Lunar games, there's really a lot of conversation going on, especially in the Silver Star Complete for the PlayStation. So that's another thing I think that made the game stand out.
Well, and, you know, the kind of characters that you team up with and who become part of Alex's party do have a big connection to the story, because so much of the plot that drives this game is based on the previous generation of heroes who are all sort of closely connected to the party. So basically, like 15, 20 years before the events of this game, There were four great heroes who traveled with the Dragon Master, Dain, and basically saved the world by helping the goddess Althina. And there's some stuff that went down at that time that people don't like to talk about, and they all kind of went their separate ways. But, you know, some of the previous heroes, there was Lake, who's basically like a sword master who you meet early in the game, who seems to be like, you know, kind of an Obi-Wan crazy old wizard type. And then he's actually turns out to be an old hero. But one of the heroes, Mel, is Jessica's father. And then another of the heroes, Galleon, is the head of the Magic Academy. Is that correct?
I think so. Yes.
Yeah, I believe so.
Affiliated with that.
Right. So basically, you know, everyone kind of has this connection to the previous generation of heroes, and that all ties in with the story of Alex and Luna, because it turns out that, spoilers, you know, when events went down before, Althina, the goddess, chose to remain mortal and be born as a human girl, who was Luna. And Galleon believed, this is more in the remake, I think, but there was like something with a black dragon in the original, but kind of, you know, they rewrote the story a lot with the sequel or the remake, so that Galleon felt like Althina and the heroes had sort of betrayed humanity, and he wanted to basically turn Luna back into Althina and reinstill her divinity. And he goes about that by teaming up with the Vile Tribe, who are the sworn enemies of Althina, which maybe doesn't seem like the best way to go about, you know, restoring the goddess's glory by teaming up with her enemies. But, you know, who am I to say? And he makes this big moving castle called, what was it, the Grindery?
Yes, that, like a sandcrawler around, or something.
Yeah, it like travels around. That's one of my most memorable moments from the game in the original, is that once that thing kind of reveals itself and starts roaming around the surface of the moon, I was like, wow, I want to go check that out. And if you go do that, it will kill you immediately. And it's game over. So recommendation for those of you playing for the first time, don't go to the Grindery when they tell you not to go to the Grindery. It's a bad idea. But yes, that gets to another point, which is that Lunar takes place on the surface of the moon. And this is something that comes out more in the sequel, but 1,000 years before the events of the game, basically there was a great evil called Zophar, and the goddess Althina pretty much said, well, you know, I'm going to stop you at great cost, and it's going to basically make Earth uninhabitable. So she used her powers to terraform a big chunk of the moon, and that's where humanity lives now. And then there's the parts that are not terraformed, and right at the boundary is where the Vile Tribe lives, kind of cast out and not allowed to live in the cool, nicely terraformed spaces that are pleasant and grassy and green. They have to live kind of in the dunes and the deserts, and they're not happy about it.
And I do think Galleon is really, in the movie remakes, he's a very good villain. I mean, as they say, a story is only as good as its villain in some cases. So he was made a big impression on a lot of players back then, especially for the voice that Working Designs gave him.
Yes, I believe the actor was John Truitt. Yep. And I don't know what else he has done, but that was, yeah, he, so Galleon was kind of one of the first sort of pretty boy, silver hair, anime bad boys, basically, like Sephiroth or Alucard or whatever.
Oh yeah, he predates Sephiroth. So
he seems to be a little bit of like an imperious, imposing kind of guy, but not a bad guy at first, but then, he kind of figures out who Alex is and Luna and reveals his true self and turns out to be really evil and stuff. And so the final boss in the original Lunar is, in fact, Galleon, the headmaster of the Magic Academy. And Alex turns out to be the new Dragon Master, which is basically like the official cool hero of Althina who teams up with the dragons to stop evil. And he gets to use a neat sword.
This might not surprise you, but apparently the only work he's done is work on either Working Designs or Gaijin Works games. So I think he's just a friend of Vic Ireland.
With a good voice.
Yeah, I do think a lot of the voice actors they originally recruited were just friends of friends. I think he knew them through work or church or something like that.
Yeah, right. The guy who played Alex in the remake, he actually became a celebrity, Ashley Angel.
Yes.
He's like a King Lord Himbo to end all himbos. But he was in the band O-Town, I believe. He was like in the band,
boy band, yeah.
That it was part of like at the time P Diddy's making the band. I think that was the first band that he made. And at the time, I was like, "That's Alex. He was in an anime. No one must know this for him to achieve any sort of fame."
That is amazing. I had not looked that up about him, but wow.
And he was just a Redding, California local who made it big.
Okay, yeah, that's where Working Designs was based. So anyway, that's pretty much Lunar in a nutshell. Like the combat system, I think, is maybe worth noting because it's. In the original game, you don't have control over your character's positioning, so it's a little bit like Chrono Trigger in that, you know, instead of just being like two lines facing off and taking turns hitting each other, you do have a battlefield where characters move out and their position kind of affects which enemies they can attack and so forth, but it's all sort of automated. Like, you don't really have control over how you move, aside from like, I'm targeting this enemy, so your character will walk over there. But in the remake, they definitely changed that up. And, you know, it adds a little something extra to the combat system. I believe, you know, area of effect attacks, if I'm remembering right, like I said, it has been a long time since I played the Sega CD version, but I think area of effect attacks, you know, can be affected by where enemies are positioned or heroes or whatever. So it becomes kind of a strategic consideration. And, you know, there are a few other effects. Trying to remember, does Nall have the ability to interact? He does, right? He like just kind of swoops in and does stuff occasionally sort of out of your control.
Yeah. I think he heals you if you sometimes if your character like dies, he sometimes will bring you back to life.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. And in the sequel, Ruby does the same thing, except she's less of a healer and more of like a tiny fire breather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you knock an enemy down to like 5 hit points, I think she'll kill it automatically, which is kind of convenient.
So that brings us to the next game, Lunar Eternal Blue, released in 1994 for Mega Drive and 95 for Sega CD. It sold okay in Japan. The Mega CD and Sega CD were both on the wane at that point. I think it really underperformed in the US compared to kind of the expectations they had for it. Because, you know, by 1995, late 95, you had the Sega Saturn and the PlayStation on the market and Virtual Boy, I guess. And, you know, people were kind of gearing up toward the Ultra 64. So the Sega CD, you know, was already kind of a niche market and was waning quickly. So
I was, I don't think I remember any other Sega CD games even coming out around that time, apart from Lunar, too.
Yeah, it was at the very tail end.
Working Designs was a big fan of putting things out after a system was functionally dead. I think it was Ark the Lad 2002 for PlayStation 1, or was it 2001? The Ark the Lad collection.
It might have been, I think it was like early 2002.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And you did have Magic Knight Ray Earth, which was, right. They made sure that was the last Saturn game.
Yep.
Oh yeah, it was April 2002, damn.
Yeah, so this was one of the last Sega CD games, if not the last. And I think it's a shame that people largely overlooked it because it is a better game, in my opinion, than the first Lunar, than the Silver Star. It's just bigger and the plot seems, I don't know, a little less like, hey, I'm going to go on an adventure, and more like, you know, the stakes are right there from the very beginning and it really pulls you in. And it also has a lot of gameplay refinements. So it just feels like a more robust and fully developed game. And it's a direct sequel to the first game that takes place 1,000 years later. So that gives him lots of time to basically kind of reset the status quo and give a little distance to say what's the result of the events of the first Lunar, where, you know, in the Silver Star at the very end, Althina, aka Luna, is like, yeah, I'm going to stay human. I'm not going to become a goddess. The world can get by without me. I just want to live a mortal life and spend the rest of my time with my brother slash lover, Alex. And we'll see where we go from there. And so this is, you know, set in a world that no longer has a goddess. And what does that mean for the people of Lunar? And what does that mean for, you know, the great powers that Althina had stopped previously? But of course, because, you know, evil always returns, it's going to come back eventually. So what happens when evil returns and there's no goddess? So it's a pretty intriguing premise, I think, for a sequel. And there's a lot of kind of surprises that happen throughout the course of the story. Some twists that you probably did not expect if you had played through the first game. You know, just a good, solid story with good characters.
Yeah, I do think that this one really plays a lot more with the general stereotypes of the game, because, you know, you have Lucia. She's kind of the typical mysterious girl with blue hair and magical powers, but she has a very, I don't want to spoil too much, but she has a very tough decision to make, because she's basically been sent to stop Zophar at any cost. And your supporting characters, you have, you know, your healer, your party's main healer is a drunkard womanizing priest, basically.
Yeah, he's Wolfwood from Trigun, basically. Ah.
And so your fast attacker, she's both a karate expert and a dancer. Mm-hmm. So they play a lot around with a lot of those things there.
Yeah, definitely. Like when you look at photos of the cast, you think, well, I know what each of these characters is going to be in battle and what their personality is going to be like. And then it turns out you're completely wrong. Mm-hmm. All of them are different than you expect and do different things.
I don't know why, for me, that this game feels much less special to me than the first game. I played each of these games once, but I have very few memories of this this second game, and I'm not sure why. It just doesn't have the same it doesn't really stick around in my head as much as the first one.
Hmm. Interesting.
Right. And you played the first one first, right? In that order.
Yeah, I played them in order for the PlayStation.
Yeah. I have noticed that some people who played the Silver Star first, they tend to prefer it and view Eternal Blue as sort of a rehash, maybe. But I always did like Eternal Blue a little more.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Like I said, I played both of these on Sega CD first and in their original release order. And I thought the Silver Star was pleasant and I enjoyed it. But then Eternal Blue, I really, really liked. I feel it's, you know, one of the strongest 16-bit RPGs, period. It's really way up there for me. And a lot of that, I think, you know, does kind of have to do with the story. Like this one really gets to that whole Nausicaa thing with the runes on the wall, you know, the introduction in Lucia Awakening. You finally get to see what the surface of the Blue Star is like, because that's where she begins. She wakes up on the Blue Star and is like, whoa, what's up? Things are wrong and off. And so, you know, she's kind of on a quest to figure out like what happened to Althina and why is the goddess gone and what am I supposed to do now? And then, you know, your protagonist Hero is on a quest himself, and you assume Hero's going to become the Dragon Master just like Alex. But then there's a big twist in the middle of the game where you're like, oh, well, I guess that's not happening. So it really kind of, I think it takes the expectations you've built with the original game and says, no, that's not quite how things are going to go. So, you know, it kind of leaves you a little kind of off kilter, a little off balance. So you don't exactly know what's going to happen. And that makes you more intrigued, and you want to see where the story is going to go from here, especially once you meet Galleon, who's been resurrected in a very surprising, unexpected sort of capacity.
You know, mm-hmm. I was thinking about it more, and 2000 was just like an amazing year for Japanese RPGs, and I think maybe I was underwhelmed by this because this came out like in America, the PlayStation version. I never played the Sega CD version, and maybe I would like it more if I played it at the time, but I played this right after I played in 2000 Chrono Cross, Vagrant Story, Valkyrie Profile, and Final Fantasy IX. So I think maybe after playing all of those games, I wasn't quite ready for a throwback at that point in my life.
Right, and I don't think it did as well as Lunar the PlayStation remake of Silver Star Sword just because it was so crowded. I mean, you actually had Grandia 2, which was a Game Arts RPG coming out the same month
as
Eternal Blue Complete. So there was a lot of competition.
Yeah. So, you know, even the original Sega CD version came out the same year as Chrono Trigger and a few other kind of big games. I think Phantasy Star 4. So... Or was that 94?
Earthbound.
How big was Earthbound in America, really?
It was big for a little boy named Bob Mackey. The box was big. The box was big.
I guess that's true, because in the you had Chrono Trigger, you even had Breath of Fire 2 and Secret of Evermore. So if you had like an RPG and you had a Super Nintendo, I guess you really didn't have any reason to go to the Sega CD just around then.
Right. So, yeah, basically Eternal Blue's eternal problem is that it keeps coming up at the end of generations against really, really strong RPG lineups. And that's a shame because it is a game that I think really stands, like I said, as one of the best 16-bit RPGs ever committed to silicon or plastic or whatever CDs are made of.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's really the best of all possible treatments of the whole, I know I keep bringing it up, but the whole idea with the boy meets blue-haired girl with magical powers.
Independent as well.
Mm-hmm. And to go back to what you said, I do like the fact that there really aren't as many guarantees in Eternal Blue as there are in the first one. I mean, heroine Lucia are meeting for the first time. She's not his childhood friend or anything like that. So you're not really assured a happy ending, and that kind of plays into the
when they first meet, he's just like this kind of rough and tumble rogue adventurer type who's, you know, digging around through ruins. He just happens to have a pink cat who flies around with him, which is kind of weird. But she is basically like this inscrutable, unknowable, emotionless goddess who can, you know, basically destroy entire cities if she wanted to with her power, until she's drained of her power shortly in. But a lot of what makes the game so interesting is that for a lot of it, Hero and Lucia are kind of painted as the bad guys, and they're sort of on the run from authorities, and she gets treated as the destroyer, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then Hero is like an accomplice to that, and so everything seems really dark and dangerous. So it's a much tenser storyline as opposed to like, hey, let's have a fun adventure and go stop the giant black castle driving around on the moon surface.
Right. And I don't know how much you'd want to give away of the ending, but the epilogue is really, that blew my mind at the time. And I'd never seen a game do that before, where it basically gives you an ending that it's not really what you want. And then it immediately says, oh, hey, here's an epilogue. Play this and maybe you'll like it.
I feel like that choice is way ahead of its time, because I feel like every sizable Japanese game I play now is like, well, here's the ending at 50 hours. And then there's like 30 more hours to play. Like, here's the normie ending. And then here's the like true gamer lifestyle ending for you.
Right. But it wasn't that demanding. I mean, like the core game is probably 25 hours long and the epilogue is another 5 to 8, I believe, if I'm remembering right. So it's not, you know, like go get your platinum trophy. It's much more of like, here is, you know, another third of the story that we had previously missed out on, and it's going to give you the resolution you want.
Yeah, and to go back to the difficulty on this, the end boss wasn't quite as hard at the epilogue. I remember him being not quite as hard as some of the other bosses in the game, especially in the American version.
Yeah, so this might be a chance to talk about some of the changes that that Working Designs made for Lunar 2, which are considerably more controversial than the changes they made for the first game. So, of course, they had the same localization choices, and I think this is where you get the Clinton jokes.
Yes.
but they totally rebalanced the difficulty, and as a result of that, the boss you fight in the Magic Academy, Borgen, who's basically Baron Harkonnen, He is infamously difficult. He has like these gravity attacks that demolish huge chunks of your HP. And I remember the first time I played this, I went to that battle like really, really frightened because I'd heard so much online about how hard that battle was. And I finished it my first time through and didn't really have too much trouble with it. But I think I might have just gotten lucky because, wow. You know, by all accounts, like it is just a brutal, nasty battle that you have to grind and grind to build up enough experience for.
It encompasses your doom, basically, because he has like three different orbs orbiting him. So you have to take those as well. And he uses the gravity attack and it completely messes up any positioning you make with your characters, I think. So it's a very tough battle.
And it doesn't help that one of the changes this game made was to kind of break out your experience points. So you have the standard experience points and then you have magic experience. And magic experience allows you to choose kind of how you build your characters, basically their spells and skills. But the game also allows you to basically save wherever you want. And Working Designs thought, well, you know, the game's not that challenging if you can just save anywhere. So they turned the magic experience system not only into like a, you know, a skill building system, but also into a currency that you use to save the game. So in order to save the game, you have to spend your magic experience points. Each level or each save is 15 times Alex's current level. So if you are level 99, then it costs nearly 1500 magic experience points to save your game each time. Which again, I did a lot of grinding or something when I played this game, because I didn't feel like that was a huge onus. It didn't feel like a big burden that kept me from saving the game when I needed to. And that didn't feel like it prevented me from leveling up my party. But I know a lot of people are really like, they really hate that system.
That did not bother me either. I mean, I remember reading about a review, that went on about it, and when I played the game, I was just so relieved that I could save anywhere that I thought it was a fair exchange that I had to spend a little magic experience.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, like you earn a pretty decent amount of magic experience from most enemies. So it means that basically you have to fight a couple of battles, maybe two or three battles, in order to be able to earn enough magic experience to save in a pinch. So I don't feel like it was, just a super debilitating choice that they made. I can see why people were like, well, you know, this isn't how they originally made the game, so this feels superfluous and arbitrary. But, you know, in terms of changes that could have damaged the overall game experience, I don't think this was one of them.
Oh yeah, it never bugged me. I mean, I would basically just save my game, and you know, when I loaded it up the next time, then I would use all my magic points, so I wouldn't have to worry about running dry.
I think a bigger controversy, or at least a more visible controversy, was the fight that Working Designs got into with Game Fan magazine.
Oh, yes, yes.
This was one of the first big industry, like, press developer feuds I can remember reading about.
Right, and I remember even reading about it on Usenet, I think, at the time, because Game Fan, Nick Desbarres, Nick Rocks, as he was called, he did a review where he completely trashed the localization. He went on about it, and I think what actually happened is he hadn't played the game all the way through, and he was having trouble with the Borgen battle. So he called Working Designs for help with that, and that Victor Ireland was really ticked off already. So that made him pull all the advertising from the magazine, and you know, it spilled over onto the internet too. So that was something I had never actually seen happen before, and I was like new to the internet as well. So I was like, wow, I know these people. I read about this. This is something interesting.
Yeah. I feel like Victor Ireland is one of those guys who tended to take note of people who dinged him. And I've seen him make, you know, remarks about people who reviewed him negatively. Although I aside from this, I haven't really seen I never really saw a lot of him just like, this person is bad, but more like, yeah, I remember what they said. I think, you know, I don't agree with them, but whatever. But you can tell he definitely internalized it a little bit. But, you know, despite the changes, whether you like them or not, it's still a great RPG. It adds more combat options. It has an auto battle feature, so you don't have to choose, you know, for like low level mobs that you fight, you don't have to go through the steps of choosing every action. You can just say, okay, team, you're going to stomp them, so just stomp them for me, which was nice. You mentioned Ruby, the flying, you know, the Gnoll equivalent in this game, how she'll go finish off debilitated enemies for you. It just has lots of nice little features like that. And again, you know, the characters are not what you would necessarily expect and kind of subvert expectations. So, yeah, it's just an enjoyable and pretty ambitious and expansive take on the RPG.
Oh, yeah, I agree totally. And it always comes up when I think of good 16-bit RPGs, like, you know, it ranked alongside Chrono Trigger for me back then.
Since we're about to leave Working Designs behind, do you mind if we talk a tiny bit more about them? Because again, I do feel like they are so important to the success of these games, not just because they publish them, because I was just thinking about why I like them, and they have a lot in common with other media things I liked, like Mystery Science Theater and like Kevin Smith, and that they felt like people like you who were very accessible. They weren't like operating in their little ivory tower in Hollywood or in Silicon Valley. Like, they were always online. This was before the era of the true era of indie games, and I remember Working Design showing you like, oh, we got our maps printed, oh, we got our finger puppets back, like just constant updates. Like, the accessibility of these people and their processes made them feel like way more human and way more relatable, even if their products were sometimes flawed.
Right, and I remember every game they released had little notes in the back. I've
yeah.
seen from Victor Island, where they basically talked about all the changes, asked you to send cards and letters. And I mean, it really amazed me at the time that, you know, someone who was working on these games was actually online, and you could ask them a question and he'd answer it, you know.
And Jeremy, you have the haiku thing in your notes. That's just like, hey, fans, we're going to put your like submissions in our video game, which felt like the biggest example of just this little tight-knit community they had together.
Yeah. So to preface that, we can talk about, I think, you know, to wrap this episode, we can talk about the remakes, Lunar Silver Star Story Complete and Lunar Eternal Blue Complete, both of which were released in the U.S. on PlayStation. I think the Silver Star Story Complete originally came out on Saturn in two different versions in Japan only, and that never came to the U.S. because Victor Ireland had a falling out with Sega and jumped ship to PlayStation and brought those games with him. But yeah, they were comprehensive overhauls of both of the games, integrating a lot of the elements that debuted in Lunar 2 on Sega CD, with a total graphical overhaul, new music. The sort of bitmap artwork became cell-based animation. It was just very elaborate, very comprehensive, very good. And, you know, Working Designs put a lot of love into the packaging, as we mentioned before. But with Eternal Blue Complete, they had a contest in their forums. Basically, there was a submission contest where you would post a haiku and people would vote on them, you know, people within the community. And the best haiku, I think like 20 of them, ended up in the Magic Guild's library as, you know, just the flavor text when you look at books. So there were like however many, 15, 20 people who got their little goofy haiku into the video game. And I was one of them. And so I have an IMDb page. and, you know, I won a little prize with like, trying to remember, there was a plush Gnoll, and I think there might have been a copy of the game. There was definitely a copy of Stephen Kent's The First Quarter, History of Video Games, which was neat.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was just a fun little contest. But my haiku was inspired by the costume that Luna wears when she becomes the goddess Althina. So the haiku is, heavenly bodies, eyes gaze in reverence, goddess in a thong. trying to get a little bit of the nature imagery and also making a joke about character designs.
That does feel like the equivalent of having like a Kickstarter backer in the game, like something that they put in. So like, again, they're ahead of their time. I do remember this. I mean, Working Design's famous for delaying their games. In fact, like the word delay is like in their motto, like mediocrity is forever, delays are temporary. And this game was delayed for so long. I think it was supposed to be like an early 2000 game. It came out in December of 2000. And I remember like, oh, the pendants aren't right and this isn't right. And by the time I got that giant, this giant box full of stuff, and I was like asking myself, I don't think this was worth it. I would have rather had this game 8 months ago than have a pendant I'll never wear. Because the thing comes with Lucia's pendant, the character in the game. And I swear to God, like I went to an anime convention the month after this game released and 20% of the people there were wearing it. Because that's the only place you could wear it.
Well, did you set up all the little character standees that came with it too? Did you use those at all?
No,
because I just remember seeing those and thinking, I set them up once and I was like, you know, what am I going to do with these?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Like, that's another one of the extras where I was like, you guys are might be going a little too far with these extras, because I'd even actually like fold them because I saw them and I was like, what do I do with these? Are they going to like hang out in my room? Or I just didn't understand that.
That was one of those that stayed in the box, but you know, it did come with a CD.
Yeah.
It came with a really stinky map. And it came, of course, with a beautiful hardbound instruction manual / strategy guide. It was just a really nice package overall. Although, you know, as always, some of the elements that were included are kind of dumb. And that's something that even now at limited run, like when I have had involvement in games, I'm like, I really want to include stuff in here that's not going to be like the finger puppets. It's got to be better than that.
I mean, these sort of went back to, they called them feelies, right? With computer games back in the day, where you'd have all these adventure games that came with extra stuff. So I will say I did like the pendant. The pendant was neat. I never wore it, but it was really a nice extra.
You could hurt somebody with that pendant too if you swung it hard enough.
Now, how about your punching puppet, Bob? Did you open up that, or did you
no.
leave the box?
And I'll tell you what happened. Like, I assumed I'd get one because I pre-ordered this game, but like my software store never had one, and I ended up working there. And I was like, "Did you guys ever get those puppets?" It's like, "Oh yeah, Dino took them all and sold them on eBay." This guy who used to work there. I was like, "That son of a." Yeah, I mean, I don't blame someone making $5.15 an hour at the mall for like finding any other way to make money, but still, I never got my puppet that I would have thrown away in 5 years.
Alas.
I think I eBayed mine at some point, yeah.
The other thing I wanted to bring up, though, that I totally forgot about was something, despite how worthless some of these extras were, despite the love that went into them, something really cool. And I don't know if the second game had this, but the first game did have like a making of documentary on a separate disc. And yes, it was basically just a puff piece for Working Designs, but I had never seen anything like that, and still that is very hard to find, like a developer commentary shipped with the same game.
Yeah, usually that's something you see only for a real like prestige release. Like I remember Final Fantasy XII had a special edition with the bonus disc, but there is one for Lunar too. There's a making of on there. And what is it, the first game that has the bonus game? It's like a Warlords game called Lords of Lunar.
Yeah, Lords of Lunar. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
I forgot about
that.
That
was neat too. That's actually a game Working Designs made all by themselves too. So also impressive.
Yeah, they really put a lot of love into these games. And I think, I want to say I read that the PlayStation version of Silver Star Story Complete sold nearly 250,000 copies.
It was the best-selling PlayStation game of the summer.
Yeah, it was huge. And, you know, considering that it was like a $70 game because of or maybe 60, but it was more expensive than average because of the massive package. That's really impressive. And for a company as small as Working Designs that I think only had, you know, just a handful of employees, that must have been just an impossible amount of money that, you know, funded them for years and years to come. And it's, you know, it's a shame that whatever happened to them. And, you know, I'm not even sure where Vic Ireland is these days. I don't think anyone's really heard from him since Summon Night 6 came out. Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, I was looking on the Gaijin Works forums and people were, you know, they apparently checked in with him over eBay just to make sure he's still around, but he hasn't really done any projects since.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, well, it's good that he's still around.
We like back now, like in 2012, so 8 years ago, we had him on Retronauts when he was starting up Gaijin Works, like in person. And that was also when like things like Monkey Paw Games was starting up, you know, re-releasing things like Tomba. And he had a good like 5 years of releasing some games with Gaijin Works. I will say a regrettable name for a publisher.
It really is, right. Yeah. I think it's a case where he really got his heart set on doing specific things that didn't work out. You know, one of the big stumbling blocks for Working Designs was the PS2 Goemon game that he was really determined to localize.
Oh, right.
And I think they had a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of finances and resources tied up with that game, and Sony of America just would not approve it. I think, you know, it was kind of the same thing with some of those Class of Heroes games for PSP. I think he really wanted to publish the last physical UMD-based PSP game in the US, Class of Heroes 2 or Class of Heroes 3. I can't remember which one. I think it might have been 3. And that never happened. And I imagine, you know, Sony shut down manufacturing. And I feel like a company that size, you know, they commit to a license and he couldn't get it to work with the business model. This is all speculation, but just, you know, kind of, especially now that I work in publishing, like I kind of understand a little more about how this works. Like, you know, you sign on to do a game, you make a commitment, you make the payments, but rather than just releasing it digitally only, I think he really wanted to put it out on UMD and it never happened. And, you know, even up to the end, when they were still publishing, you know, still kind of making publicity for Gaijin Works, there was talk about the UMD version of Class of Heroes 3, and that obviously never happened. And so Summon Knight 6 came and went, and that was pretty much it for the company. But, you know, it is part of a legacy of you know, entities that brought us games like Lunar and Lunar 2 and the remakes for PlayStation, which were really remarkable. And it took a long time for the rest of the industry to catch up. And you do see more of the sort of special editions now as kind of a standard release for a lot of publishers. You know, they are an incentive to buy a game and to spend a little extra on this special version of a game. But for Working Designs, it wasn't the special version. That was just, that's how the game came. It was a great game that they really believed in. And so they put everything into this one version, and that was how it was going to be.
Right.
Wishing on a dream that seems far off, hoping it will come today into the starlit night. Foolish dreamers turn their gaze, waiting on a shooting star.
And for the PlayStation remakes of the games, if you compare them, you can see how Lunar the Silver Star is really, there are a lot more changes to that compared to the Sega CD than there are to Eternal Blue. Eternal Blue kind of follows the same plot, a lot of the same dialogues, but Silver Star changes quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it turns Luna into a character as opposed to an object. Like, she doesn't decide, oh, I'm just going to be a homemaker back here in Berg. Like, she goes off with Alex and is a part of his party long after, I think, Ramus leaves. She's with you for quite a while until she basically is abducted and turned into the Thong Goddess. And, it really, you know, I think does a lot to build the relationship between her and Alex. It also helps that Alex has dialogue and he has a personality. He gets to be a character, which is something that you saw with Hero in Eternal Blue. But Alex was, you know, the sort of laconic hero a la Chrono. And, you know, when you're really selling a game on the core relationship between its lead character and his love, you need, I think, for that character to be able to voice his thoughts and feelings and to kind of understand, like, what is this guy about, as opposed to just, you know, killing monsters and letting his dragons talk for him.
And I just saw on the Gaijin Works release page, a lot of what they did was making available digital releases for some of their titles on the PS3, some of their old titles like Ark the Lad and Vanguard Bandits and stuff. But what is the availability of these games, the PlayStation versions, of course? And, like, I know there's some weird rights issues because there's a lot of pieces of this pie. Like, what do we think about what's going to happen to the future of this, if it'll ever be playable again?
Yeah, Todd, did you want to talk a little bit about what happened with Studio Alex and Game Arts and, you know, kind of the state of things?
Oh, yeah. To answer Bob's question, you can actually get Eternal Blue Complete off of the Japanese PlayStation Network. And you can buy, of course, I don't know if we were going to talk about the PSP version.
Yeah.
I don't think we're going to have time this episode, okay. but yeah, there were a couple of other remakes. So,
But just to go into the Studio Alex and Game Arts thing, around the time that Silver Star Story Complete was being made for the PlayStation, Studio Alex basically sued Game Arts because they were cutting them out of the remake. And Game Arts countersued Studio Alex because Studio Alex apparently had taken too long to make the game Lunar Walking School or Magical School Lunar, like they'd gone over budget. And so it was a court case that took years to decide, but Game Arts basically won and Studio Alex kind of went under. I think the programmer, the guy who founded it, he's actually working at Gainax right now. And you can even kind of see this in the late 90s because Game Arts started up the Grandia series. Sort of so they wouldn't have to share it with Studio Alex, I think. So they invited a lot of people from Lunar Games to the Grandia series, including the composer, the writer, but just not Studio Alex. And I do think they kind of lost a little something without Studio Alex because if you look at Studio Alex's other games, they were willing to maybe counteract cliches a little bit. One of the few games they made outside of Lunar and outside of Game Arts is called Getzendiener, and it's just an action game about a princess who gets kidnapped, and she has to rescue herself. So I think it's kind of a shame that Studio Alex really didn't get the chance to do much more in video games.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a shame also that these games are really kind of bogged down in rights issues. I'm positive that Vic Ireland had talked about, you know, getting the rights to put these games on PlayStation Network, and it just never happened. And so I think the only way you can play a Lunar game in the year of our Lord 2020 is to buy Lunar Silver Star Harmony, the PSP remake of the PlayStation game, and get that on PlayStation Network. And I believe you can play that on PSP and Vita, both of which are now dead and abandoned systems. So yeah, I don't know. Like maybe if the PlayStation 5, if they really go all in on backward compatibility or like, hey, we've got a PSP mode here, which they could very easily do because there is a PSP shell emulator that works, you know, for like Castlevania, the Rondo of Blood and Symphony of the Night release Requiem, that's what it's called, like that is a PSP emulator. So yeah, like it's totally feasible for them to make it happen. Like it's possible for them to put the early Lunar games Complete 1 and 2 on, like get the PS1 ROMs, make those PS1 classics that would work in the PSP emulator on PS5's PS4 backward compatibility, whatever, just like get 20 layers of emulation. I'm sure it would be fine and it'd be nice to be able to play these games, but unfortunately that is not realistically something you can do right now, and realistically probably something they're not going to want to make the effort to do, especially with the legal rights bogging things down. It's just a lot of hoops to jump through. So I think we're kind of SOL with these games.
That's a shame. Yeah. We don't have time to talk about it, but I could never get into all like three of the, are there three remakes or two?
There's two additional remakes. There's the Game Boy Advance one, Lunar Legend, which is greatly simplified and not that great. And then Lunar Silver Star Harmony for PSP, which we were just talking about, which actually is a very solid remake of Silver Star Story Complete. It's simplified a little bit, but not dumbed down to the point that the GBA game is.
Yeah, for whatever reason, I just could not get into either one of those, and I gave both of them a shot because I really wanted to replay the game.
Yeah, I feel like they do miss a little something that is like that special sauce that makes these games so appealing and intriguing. But I will say that Silver Star Harmony is way, way better than Dragon Song, the horrible misstep for Nintendo DS, which is technically the last new Lunar game. It was developed for DS in 2005. Could have been one of the first great DS RPGs, but it really, really wasn't.
Right, yeah, and it's a prequel, actually, I think, to the original Lunar, but not in an interesting way. I mean, it doesn't really deal with, you know, this war or this conflict that led Alfina to colonize the moon at all. It just sort of, it's set like a couple hundred years before, and it just very going through the motions.
It's narratively, but like in terms of gameplay, it really feels like one of those cases where the person who was in charge of it was like, well, you know, this is how RPGs work, and that's boring. We've got to put our spin on it. So they made a lot of really bad creative choices in terms of mechanics and systems, and it's just a mess. It is
right.
Like, how can you mess up an RPG this badly?
Well, you can start by deplete hit points when you dash around. So if you want to move faster than walking, you actually lose your hit points.
And you that can sounds even, fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I gamefly'd this in like 2006 and it was sent back like the next day.
Yeah, you basically have auto combat, and when you go into battle, you have to choose, do I want items from this battle or do I want experience? You can't have both. You have to arbitrarily choose at the beginning of battle what you're going to benefit from the battle. For me, the best thing about Lunar Dragon Song is the Wikipedia roundup of critical and review lamentations. It's just like paragraph after paragraph of people just saying, why is this so bad? How can a game be this terrible?
Oh, yeah. I think it even made some worst of the year lists mm-hmm. when it came out or something.
Yep.
And to go back to the reason, I mean, unfortunately, I'm not sure how well Silver Star Harmony did or how well the Game Boy Advance game did, but it probably wasn't well enough to get them to remake Eternal Blue, which is mm-hmm. kind of unfortunate because Lunar 2, Eternal Blue really seems like it has to basically wait to see how well a Lunar Silver Star remake does before it can even get off the ground. And it never really happens. It's never got another remake.
Yeah, I mean, Silver Star Harmony was really late in the PSP's life. It was, you know, released here in 2010. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was, what, 5 years after the PSP? It was really kind of winding down. And, you know, by that point, it had really faded a lot in the U.S. And in Japan, it was still popular, but mostly for playing Monster Hunter. And this was not that. So right. I just don't think it was the right platform or the right place for it. Like, I could see a Lunar remake doing well, maybe on Switch, if it had come out a couple of years ago. I think at this point, the Switch is just, you know, overloaded with games like that. So it would be another case of too little too late. But yeah, I think the series is really dogged by game arts and, you know, whoever is kind of funding the remakes always sort of missing the ball and coming in too late in a generation to really, really have proper impact. So maybe it's just as well that Lunar is kind of a thing of the past. Like, there's probably never going to be another Lunar game. And as you mentioned in the notes, like, what would that even be? Because Lunar 2 wraps everything up.
It does. And I think that the rumor was at some point in the early 2000s, they tried putting a Lunar 3 together on the drawing boards. And from some former working designs people, from what they said, it looked terrible. It didn't really involve anyone from the earlier games. And I've never even seen any production work on it. So maybe it's for the best.
And what about you, Bob? Do you have hopes for the future for Lunar, or are you happy to let it be, you know, a legend of the past?
I'm okay with no more Lunar, not to be a stick in the mud or whatever. I just feel like for me, these games flourished in the context of when they were released, and I don't think they're as special outside of that. Although I do really love my memories of them, I feel like a third game would just kind of be meaningless compared to what the first two games offered.
Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer in, you know, not drawing things out too much and saying, you know, like, this thing was good and I'm glad that we had it and we don't need more of it because it's just going to diminish what was good. So yeah, farewell Lunar. It was good times. Mm-hmm. I would like to see, you know, some of the classic games made available on current systems somehow in some capacity because they've gotten really expensive. And I think those are kind of the ideal way to play the games.
Right, right. And to go back, I think we skipped over Magical School Learner. If we could just to touch on that, that was the Game Gear game remade for the Saturn. Some people were thinking that would be like Lunar 3 for them, but it's very much a side story. And that got, you mentioned that got translated by a fan translation mm-hmm. a few years ago.
Yep.
Yeah.
Actually, so like that's 11 or 12 years now. It's been a while.
Oh, yeah. Was it the Game Gear game, or what did they actually do the Saturn game?
I'm pretty sure it was the Game Gear game. I looked it up at romhacking.net, and I only saw Game Gear. So I don't know that the Saturn version has been localized, which is right. A shame because it looks more like what you expect from a Lunar game. the Game Gear game, like when you get into combat, it looks more like Phantasy Star, which, you know, that's fine, but it's not kind of what you think. Oh, Lunar.
Right. It's very much the Saturn game is very much just a lighthearted side story. It's not nearly as bad as Dragon Song, but it doesn't really have the same impact as the main Lunar. So
I guess it is nice to know that if you want more Lunar, there's one like half a Lunar out there you haven't played and someone has translated it for you. So it might not get you where you need to go, but it's still something.
Yeah, it's half sort of a demi Lunar.
A loon.
Yes.
All right, so that, I think, is it. That's we actually did get through the whole Lunar series, and maybe it didn't go as deeply into some of the latter-day games as I intended, but honestly, we probably said enough about them. But a great series in its day, I think very, very influential, and in the late 90s, there was a real, a genuine, fervent fan base around the series. It fueled working designs with its popularity and success for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. And I would still recommend the first two games today for people who are really who like the aesthetics of a 16-bit game and who like the tropes of that era and things like that, especially Lunar 2. I think it deserves to be played by more people.
Yeah, like if you really enjoy those Kimco RPGs that keep showing up,
oh my God.
Like this is what those are basically modeled after, but they're better. Like these are the good version of those. Mm-hmm. It's maybe a bad idea for me to say that too loudly since we're Limited Run publishes those, but you know, they definitely have their fans, but I think they're fine, but these games are great, and this is very much, you know, kind of what is front of mind for Kimco's teams like Hit Point and so forth. Like this is what they're aiming for. So go back and try the originals, and I think even now, you know, even though we've kind of spoiled a lot of the plot here, there's still stuff we didn't really talk about. And if you just, you know, spend like 50 hours on these two games, that's a fair amount of time, I realize, but they're satisfying and fun, and I think, you know, you can still feel a connection to these characters and worlds.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, Todd, thank you very much for joining us to talk about Lunar and Game Arts and Studio Alex and Working Designs and so on and so forth. I think this is the time for you to pimp yourself. So please let us know where we can find you on the internet.
Well, I do still have my ancient little blog called www.kidfenris.com. But my friend and Joel and I actually just started a new YouTube feature. It's called Unsung Game Creators, and we're kind of spotlighting game developers that might not be that well known. And maybe we'll do something on Studio Alex. So definitely check that out.
All right.
And I'm on Twitter as Kid Fenris, KIDFENRIS.
All right.
And that's what you get when you name yourself as a teenager.
Hey, me too.
And Bob, how about you?
Hey, everybody. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. I have a few other podcasts, by the way, that's Talking Simpsons, a chronological exploration of the Simpsons. And What a Cartoon. We look at a different cartoon from a different series every week. You can find those wherever you find podcasts or go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Go there and find all kinds of bonus stuff. And right now we have just kicked off Talking Futurama Season 2, Part 2. We're going through the back half of Futurama second season only on the Patreon at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, Magic Emperor Jeremy Parrish, as a guy on the internet at places like Twitter, where I'm called GameSpite, and on YouTube, where I am called Jeremy Parrish, and just doing stuff around other places and so on and so forth. And of course, Retronauts, you know, because this is a patron exclusive episode of Retronauts, and therefore you're here because you've bought into what we do and you support us, and we appreciate it. So thank you very much for backing us and for making this episode possible. I hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you enjoyed having Todd on the show. Todd, I'd love to have you back again sometime.
Oh, yes, definitely. This was
talk
amazing.
About Telenet or something. I don't know.
Oh, yes. Wolf Team.
That's been on the calendar for quite a while. We'll get you and Shane Bettenhausen. It's going to be a free-for-all.
We will do a second Fester's Quest episode with Todd.
Sure. Anytime.
Yes. Thanks, everyone, for supporting the show. And we will be back in I guess, a week from now. No, a few days with another episode of the podcast. So look forward to it. And until then, check this out.